Chapter 28. In the study a half hour later, Mr. Spence, watch in hand, was doling out his minutes again. The peril conjured, he had recovered his dominion over time. He turned his commanding eyeglasses on Milner. It's all settled then? Tell Draper I'm sorry not to see him again tonight, but I'm to speak at the dinner of the Legal Relief Association, and I'm due there in 5 minutes. You and he dine alone here, I suppose? Tell him I appreciate what he's done. Someday he'll see that to leave the world better than we find it is the best we can hope to do. You finished the notes for the investigator? Be sure you don't forget that phrase. Well, good evening. That's all, I think. Smooth and compact in his glossy evening clothes, Mr. Spence advanced toward the study door. But as he reached it, his secretary stood there before him. It's not quite all, Mr. Spence. Mr. Spence turned on him a look in which impatience was faintly tinged with apprehension. What else is there? It's 2:30. Milner stood his ground. It won't take longer than that. I want to tell you that, if you can conveniently replace me, I'd like there are reasons why I shall have to leave you. Milner was conscious of reddening as he spoke. His redness deepened under Mr. Spence's dispassionate scrutiny. He saw at once that the banker was not surprised at his announcement. Well, I suppose that's natural enough. You'll want to make a start for yourself now. Only, of course, for the sake of appearances, oh, certainly, Milner hastily agreed. Well then, is that all? Mr. Spence repeated. Nearly. Milner paused, as if in search of an appropriate formula. But after a moment he gave up the search, and pulled from his pocket an envelope which he held out to his employer. I merely want to give this back. The hand which Mr. Spence had extended dropped to his side, and his sand-colored face grew chalky. Gee, give it back? His voice was as thick as Milner's. What's happened? Is the bargain off? Oh, no. I've given you my word. Your word? Mr. Spence lowered at him. I'd like to know what that's worth. Milner continued to hold out the envelope. Why, you do know now. It's worth that. It's worth my place. Mr. Spence, standing motionless before him, hesitated for an appreciable space of time. His lips parted once or twice under their square-clipped stubble, and at last emitted how much more do you want? Milner broke into a laugh. Oh, I've got all I want, all and more. What from the others? Are you crazy? No, you are, said Milner with a sudden recovery of composure. But you're safe as you'll ever be. Only I don't care to take this for making you so. Mr. Spence slowly moistened his lips with his tongue, and removing his pince-nez, took a long, hard look at Milner. I don't understand. What other guarantee have I got? That I mean what I say? Milner glanced past the banker's figure at his rich, densely colored background of Spanish leather and mahogany. He remembered that it was from this very threshold that he had first seen Mr. Spence's son. What guarantee? You've got Draper, he said. Afterward, there is one, of course, but you will never know it. The assertion, laughingly flung out 6 months earlier in a bright June garden, came back to Mary Boyne with a sharp perception of its latent significance as she stood, in the December dusk, waiting for the lamps to be brought into the library. The words had been spoken by their friend Alida Stair, as they sat at tea on her lawn at Pangburn, in reference to the very house, of which the library in question was the central, the pivotal feature. Mary Boyne and her husband, in quest of a country place in one of the southern or southwestern counties, had, on their arrival in England, carried their problem straight to Alida Stair, who had successfully solved it in her own case. But it was not until they had rejected, almost capriciously, several practical and judicious suggestions, that she threw it out colon well, there's Ling, in Dorsetshire. It belongs to Hugo's cousins, and you can get it for a song. The reason she gave for its being obtainable on these terms its remoteness from a station, its lack of electric light, hot water pipes, and other vulgar necessities were exactly those pleading in its favor with two romantic Americans perversely in search of the economic drawbacks which were associated, in their tradition, with unusual architectural felicities. I should never believe I was living in an old house, unless I was thoroughly uncomfortable, Ned Boyne, the more extravagant of the two, had jocosely insisted. The least hint of convenience would make me think it had been bought out of an exhibition, with the pieces numbered, and set up again. And they had proceeded to enumerate, with humorous precision, their various suspicions and exactions, refusing to believe that the house their cousin recommended was really Tudor till they learned it had no heating system, or that the village church was literally in the grounds till she assured them of the deplorable uncertainty of the water supply. It's too uncomfortable to be true. Edward Boyne had continued to exult as the avowal of each disadvantage was successively wrung from her, but he had cut short his rhapsody to ask, with a sudden relapse to distrust Colin and the ghost, "You've been concealing from us the fact that there is no ghost." Mary, at the moment, had laughed with him, yet almost with her laugh, being possessed of several sets of independent perceptions, had noted a sudden flatness of tone in Lydia's answering hilarity. "Oh, Dorsetshire's full of ghosts, you know." "Yes, yes, but that won't do. I don't want to have to drive 10 miles to see somebody else's ghost. I want one of my own on the premises. Is there a ghost at Ling?" His rejoinder had made a little laugh again, and it was then that she had flung back tantalizingly, "Colin, oh, there is one, of course, but you will never know it." "Never know it?" Boyne pulled her up. "But what in the world constitutes a ghost except the fact of its being known for one?" "I can't say. But that's the story. That there's a ghost, but that nobody knows it's a ghost?" "Well, not till afterward, at any rate."
"Till afterward?"
"Not till long, long afterward. But if it's once been identified as an unearthly visitant, why hasn't its signalement been handed down in the family? How has it managed to preserve its incognito?" Alida could only shake her head. "Dee, don't ask me. But it has." And then suddenly Mary spoke up, as if from some cavernous depth of divination, "Suddenly, long afterward, one says to oneself, that was it?" Apostrophe, she was oddly startled at the sepulchral sound with which her question fell on the banter of the other two, and she saw the shadow of the same surprise flit across Alida's clear pupils. I suppose so. One just has to wait."
"Oh, hang waiting," Ned broke in. "Life's too short for a ghost who can only be enjoyed in retrospect. Can't we do better than that, Mary?" But it turned out that in the event they were not destined to, for within 3 months of their conversation with Mrs. Stair they were established at Ling, and the life they had yearned for to the point of planning it out in all its daily details had actually begun for them. It was to sit, in the thick December dusk, by just such a wide-hooded fireplace, under just such black oak rafters, with the sense that beyond the mullioned panes the downs were darkening to a deeper solitude. It was for the ultimate indulgence in such sensations that Mary Boyne had endured for nearly 14 years the soul-deadening ugliness of the Middle West, and that Boyne had ground on doggedly at his engineering till, with a suddenness that still made her blink, the prodigious windfall of the Blue Star Mine had put them at a stroke in possession of life, and the leisure to taste it. They had never for a moment meant their new state to be one of idleness, but they meant to give themselves only to harmonious activities. As he had her vision of painting and gardening against a background of gray walls, he dreamed of the production of his long-planned book on the economic basis of culture, and with such absorbing work ahead no existence could be too sequestered. They could not get far enough from the world, or plunge deep enough into the past. Dorsetshire had attracted them from the first by a semblance of remoteness out of all proportion to its geographical position.
but to the Boines it was one of the ever-recurring wonders of the whole incredibly compressed island, a nest of counties, as they put it, that for the production of its effects so little of a given quality went so far, that so few miles made a distance, and so short a distance a difference. It's that, Ned at once enthusiastically explained, that gives such depth to their effects, such relief to their least contrasts. They've been able to lay the butter so thick on every exquisite mouthful. The butter had certainly been laid on thick at Ling. The old gray house, hidden under a shoulder of the downs, had almost all the finer marks of commerce with a protracted past. The mere fact that it was neither large nor exceptional made it, to the Boines, abound the more richly in its special sense, the sense of having been for centuries a deep, dim reservoir of life. The life had probably not been of the most vivid order. For long periods, no doubt, it had fallen as noiselessly into the past as the quiet drizzle of autumn fell, hour after hour, into the green fish pond between the yews. But these backwaters of existence sometimes breed, in their sluggish depths, strange acuities of emotion, and Mary Boine had felt from the first the occasional brush of an intenser memory. The feeling had never been stronger than on the December afternoon when, waiting in the library for the belated lamps, she rose from her seat and stood among the shadows of the hearth. Her husband had gone off, after luncheon, for one of his long tramps on the downs. As he had noticed of late, that he preferred to be unaccompanied on these occasions, and, in the trite security of their personal relations, had been driven to conclude that his book was bothering him, and that he needed the afternoons to turn over in solitude the problems left from the morning's work. Certainly the book was not going as smoothly as he had imagined it would, and the lines of perplexity between his eyes had never been there in his engineering days. Then he had often looked fagged to the verge of illness, but the native demon of Ori had never branded his brow. Yet the few pages he had so far read to her the introduction, and a synopsis of the opening chapter gave evidences of a firm possession of his subject, and a deepening confidence in his powers. The fact threw her into deeper perplexity, since, now that he had done with Usiness and its disturbing contingencies, the one other possible element of anxiety was eliminated. Unless it were his health, then. But physically he had gained, since they had come to Dorsetshire, grown robuster, ruddier, and fresher-eyed. It was only within a week that as he had felt in him the undefinable change that made her restless in his absence, and as tongue-tied in his presence, as though it were she who had a secret to keep from him. The thought that there was a secret somewhere between them struck her with a sudden smart rap of wonder, and she looked about her down the dim, long room. Can it be the house? She mused. The room itself might have been full of secrets. They seemed to be piling themselves up, as evening fell, like the layers and layers of velvet shadow dropping from the low ceiling, the dusky walls of books, the smoke-blurred sculpture of the hooded hearth. Why, of course the house is haunted, she reflected. The ghost alit as imperceptible ghost, after figuring largely in the banter of their first month or two at Ling, had been gradually discarded as too ineffectual for imaginative use. Mary had, indeed, as became the tenant of a haunted house, made the customary inquiries among her few rural neighbors, but, beyond a vague, "They do say so, ma'am," the villagers had nothing to impart. The elusive specter had apparently never had sufficient identity for a legend to crystallize about it, and after a time the Boines had laughingly set the matter down to their profit and loss account, agreeing that Ling was one of the few houses good enough in itself to dispense with supernatural enhancements. And I suppose, poor, ineffectual demon, that's why it beats its beautiful wings in vain in the void, Mary had laughingly concluded. Or, rather, Ned answered, in the same strain, why, amid so much that's ghostly, it can never affirm its separate existence as the ghost. And thereupon their invisible housemate had finally dropped out of their references, which were numerous enough, to make them promptly unaware of the loss. Now, as she stood on the hearth, the subject of their earlier curiosity revived in her with a new sense of its meaning, a sense gradually acquired through close daily contact with the scene of the lurking mystery. It was the house itself, of course, that possessed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.